On behalf of the Federalist Society, let me welcome everybody to the 2010 Appellate Judicial Candidates Forum in Raleigh. This forum is the second of a two-part series. The first judicial forum was held earlier this month in Winston-Salem. The video for that forum is available on the website of the Federalist Society at www.fed-soc.org and as well, voterradio.org. Tonight's forum will be available on that website, www.fed-soc.org, as well as voterradio.org, and the website of our co-sponsor, the John Locke Foundation. The Federalist Society will soon expand its website for these forums to include full videos, as well as selected clips for easier viewing to make them as accessible as possible to all North Carolina voters. We invite you to share these videos with anyone who is interested in learning more about the candidates. If you forget these website addresses, just Google the Federalist Society and it'll come right up. The Federalist Society is an educational organization that does not endorse candidates or take policy positions. Its foundational principle is the proposition that it is emphatically the province of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it ought to be. My name is Robert Shaw, and I'm a lawyer at the firm of Williams Mullen and the chair of the Triangle Chapter of the Federalist Society. We have invited all of the candidates for the appellate judicial races this year, except the 13 candidates for the Court of Appeals seat vacated by Judge James Wynn, who has recently been confirmed for a seat on the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. We will host these 13 candidates on October 7th at noon at the John Locke Foundation. All of the candidates we have invited, except for Judge Bob Hunter, are here this evening. And Judge Hunter sends his regrets that he will not be able to attend the forum. Let me remind the candidates that when I hold up a yellow card, then you have 30 seconds left to answer. When I hold up a red card, then your 90 seconds will have expired. Our moderator will be the Honorable Willis Wichard, former Associate Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court, and former dean of the Adrian Wiggins School of Law at Campbell University. Once again, I would like to thank our co-sponsor, the John Locke Foundation, and thank you for participating in the democratic process for electing judges in North Carolina. And now, let me turn over the forum to Justice Willis Wichard.
Thank you very much, Robert. Welcome to all of you for this exercise in small d democratic governance. The judiciary is a very important branch in our government. All of these folks are offering themselves for positions on the appellate bench, and I thank them for being willing to offer themselves in a forum of this nature, and all of you for coming. The questions have been prepared by the society. I have discretion to ask some of my own at the end, but I'm guessing that these will pretty much take the time. For purposes of the questioning, the candidates are paired, i.e., those running for the same seat, simply in order to give some order to the process. At the outset, I have decided that in each group, I will pose the question first to the incumbent, if there is one, and then second to the non-incumbent. In the one race for a Supreme Court seat, as Robert indicated, Judge Hunter is not here. Judge Stillman is a candidate for his seat, and the society has chosen to pair them for purposes of responding to the question, but they wanted to emphasize that they are not running against each other. So, with that explanation of the format, I'm going to pose the first question to Judge Jackson, since she is the one candidate here for the highest court. And following her response, Judge Stillman will respond. question is, our nation has witnessed a continuing debate in recent years about the proper role of the judicial branch. This debate is often framed as being between, quote, judicial activism and, quote, judicial restraint. How would you describe this debate, and what is your perspective on it? Judge Jackson.
I have been asked this question before, and I think that, you know, the terms have almost taken on a life of their own, so I'm a little reluctant to subscribe to them. I think in my own mind, I would tend to be a little bit more towards judicial restraint. My judicial philosophy is that I believe it's up to judges to judge and to leave it to the legislature to legislate. I don't think that the courts should act in the role of a super legislature, and I would tend to take a fairly narrow view of the role of the courts, believing, much as I think our founders did, that we have a fairly limited role in the government and in the role of separation of powers.
Judge Steelman.
I think that our role is to clearly enforce the Constitution and to give the federal Constitution and the state Constitution preeminence in what we do. Those should be the guiding lights, and we have to protect those constitutional rights in all cases. I don't think it's the role of the judiciary to try and seek out things in the Constitution that are not there. I don't think that's our role. As far as statutes, I think our role is to interpret those statutes and not try and change their meaning, but to give effect to what the General Assembly has intended to do. So I probably am on the in the spectrum more towards judicial, what's known as judicial restraint, rather than judicial activism.
Thank you. Second question will go to Judge Elmore and Mr. Walker, with Judge Elmore responding first. What kinds of problems do you most often see in cases you believe were wrongly decided? Excluding the Dred Scott case, the propounders of the question say the answer to that would be too easy. What would be an example of an appellate decision, state or federal, that you think was particularly bad or wrong? Judge Elmore.
Well, I think the initial part of the question was the problems that we see coming to the appellate court, and more often than not, those are evidentiary issues where the lower courts have made a ruling as to the admissibility of evidence. That does come to our attention on appeal, and we have to take a close look at it and to decide it one way or the other. Most prevalently, that happens with criminal cases where there is a substantial amount of evidence introduced by both the prosecution and the defense, and the defense often will object for evidence that is admitted that they think should not be admitted, and then they assign that as issues that come up to the Court of Appeals. And that is what we, in my 8 years on the court, am most accustomed to see.
Mr. Walker.
I think most of the time when we see issues that are coming up where there's been mistakes made is just an inattention to detail. Often what happens is there'll be a case, or the case won't be researched properly. Somebody's missed something down the road. There'll be, for instance, something like a Supreme Court case that seems to be directly on point, and it won't be cited, it won't be quoted, and then you wonder why that has to be fixed on appeal from the Court of Appeals up to the Supreme Court. And it happens as well from things that trial courts look at when it comes up to the Court of Appeals. I think you were looking for a Supreme Court case that we disagree with. Besides Dred Scott, was that part of the question there? Mm-hmm. Well, I guess if I had to pick one off the top of my head, I'm sure I could get some more in there. But I think the Kelo decision was not a good decision. I think anytime we're talking about taking private property and calling it for public use, but we're really giving it for private use, we've got some serious constitutional issues there. And I thought that was just a bad decision all the way around.
Thank you. Next question will go to Judges Calabria and Gray. And the question is, what judge do you believe has been the most influential judge in American history? Or, if you prefer, what judge has been most influential to you? You may qualify your answer by indicating you don't necessarily agree with everything that judge may have decided. Judge Calabria.
One of the most influential judges would be Justice Scalia. And the reason we have so many cases, so many criminal cases on our court, and one of his decisions, Crawford versus Washington, completely followed the Constitution as he... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm looking at him instead of talking in here. I'll start over again. I'm sorry. Justice Scalia would be my justice that I would... my time start over since... Thank you. And I cited the case of Crawford versus Washington because of the right to confrontation in a criminal case. We have so many criminal cases that prior to that case, and of course there were other cases before that that were, he authored that, but I believe that because of our Constitution, we have to protect people's rights, and that is one of the cases that I so much thought. I believe that it was complicated, and we had lots of discussion in the Institute of Government over it, but we have consistently enjoyed having that particular case because of the following the right to confrontation.
Judge Gray.
I think of the many justices that have produced some amazing opinions, and while I'm going to be the worst at giving you a case name, I think about Justice Cardozo and the great skill he had in writing a decision that was understandable, not just to the lawyers who were involved in the case, but I would contend to the public who might have read those decisions. That is something that I would always aspire to. I have answered a question about a judge that has influenced me or one that I have admired, and I do find as a trial judge that I have looked to our senior resident Superior Court judge here in Wake County, Don Stevens. He has been one that I have known for 35 years. He has been always a person who exercises incredible restraint, but with a sense of humor. I try not to let my sense of humor get in there too much, but I sometimes let that slip. But I do greatly admire his ability to dispense justice with a fair hand, and always, always think about the party in front of them as if no one else was there. He gets all the tough ones. I don't know how he does it on a day-to-day basis, but I also appreciate his door is always open, and I try to ascribe to that same philosophy that my door is open if you want to come talk to me.
Justices Edmonds and Newby are here. Former Justice Wichert is here, and we're all bitterly disappointed that nobody picked us. The next question will go to Judge Geer and Mr.
Poirier.
Poirier. If you could recommend one book, essay, or judicial opinion for all judges to read, what would it be, Judge Geer?
Now, that is challenging. I mean, the book is easy, To Kill a Mockingbird. I think if you talk to most lawyers, they're going to say that. When I've been interviewed, people say, oh, well, that's always mentioned. But if you read it, it is what It sets out what has inspired so many people to go into law, and it represents the highest calling for lawyers. In terms of opinions, I have to say that the Crawford decision, which you've already heard mentioned, really is a fascinating one to read because of it goes all the way back to the Magna Carta and lays everything out. It talks about Sir Walter Raleigh. I think it is a fun decision to read and comes out with it, and it was a record. It is an amazing decision. A justice of the Supreme Court, who is routinely identified as the most conservative court, and people who believe in judicial restraint go with Justice Scalia, and yet this decision is probably greater than Miranda in terms of expanding the rights of criminal defendants. I think it really is an extraordinary piece of work.
I would recommend that they read a book called Everybody's Normal Until You Get to Know Them. It's by a gentleman named John Ortberg. And what it goes into is the fact that we're all damaged goods in the eyes of God. We're all created with value and purpose, but we all make mistakes. We're all flawed. And sometimes judges have a tendency to forget that they're public servants, and they slide from humility to arrogance. And we must never do that. We must remember that we're part of a common, flawed humanity and take that into account when we make our decisions.
Thank you. Next question goes to Judges Jackson and Steelman, with Judge Steelman first. North Carolina was recently ranked by the Consumer News and Business Channel as the fourth best state for business in the United States. Should the judicial branch play a role in ensuring that North Carolina remains a business-friendly environment? And if so, what role should the judicial branch play? Judge Steelman.
I think the judicial branch has already done this. I was appointed by Chief Justice Lake to serve on the Business Court Commission, where we expanded the business court in North Carolina. And the business court is not designed just to help business. The purpose is to make sure that we have a coherent and understandable body of business law in North Carolina that everyone can understand and is carefully reasoned. So I think that's a tremendous benefit. It allows complex business disputes to get the detailed attention that they need and to have judges who are trained in this area to make those decisions. Of course, on the appellate court, we get to review those decisions, and those are some of the most challenging cases that we get to hear. So I think that was a major step forward that we did in North Carolina, emulating what the state of Delaware has done for many, many years with their chancery court, which has encouraged a tremendous amount of business to come and make their homes in the state of Delaware.
Judge Jackson.
I certainly would concur with everything that Judge Steelman has said and can't improve on that aspect of our court system. One thing that both Judge Steelman and I have been involved in is the Dispute Resolution Commission, which also offers all participants in the judicial system an opportunity to resolve their cases more quickly and efficiently at all levels of the court system, from the district court through the superior court. Mandatory opportunities in those two courts, and at our appellate court, the Court of Appeals does participate in a voluntary dispute resolution program. So we are also offering opportunities to business and to private individuals to resolve their disputes more quickly through dispute resolution, alternative dispute resolution, mediation, and other programs as well. So I think there really is a role for the judiciary in making justice be more swift and more efficient as well.
Thank you. Next question to Judge Elmore and Mr. Walker, with Mr. Walker first. Let me say that this is one where I'm going to exercise the discretion the society has given me to modify the question somewhat. The question, as prepared by the society, is when is it appropriate for a North Carolina court to look at another state's case law to decide a case? And I'm going to add, when is it appropriate to look at foreign case law in deciding a case? Mr. Walker.
I'll answer the first part of the question first as far as looking at other states. Sometimes it's helpful to look at other states, what other states have done in similar issues, just because for the most part, states have similar governments, not all the way across the board, but sometimes it helps to be able to look. If you're looking at a case of first impression in North Carolina, it's a good idea to look. What has South Carolina done on this issue? What has New York done on this issue? What has Florida done on this issue? Try to stay away from what California's done on this issue. You just do what you've got to do, and you look at it and find that out. I think it becomes more problematic when you start looking into foreign law because you've got such a difference in government there, such a difference in the way we have instituted our government to be of limited powers. You don't have that all over the world. And so I think it becomes problematic to start looking at foreign law. I think it's okay to look at state law when there's nothing controlling in our own court system or something that's a binding precedent from a court above, but I think foreign law becomes much more problematic.
Judge Elmore.
Yes, I'll start out with the foreign law aspect of that. Being on the Court of Appeals, I don't even recall a case coming to mind now where we were asked by the parties involved to closely adhere to any recitations of law from foreign countries. So that really doesn't enter into the picture quite that much, if at all. As to other states, we have the finest North Carolina Supreme Court among Supreme Courts in the nation right here, and all we have to do is follow their guidance on the issues of law raised by the parties. Now, if it is a matter of first impression, what happens is often the parties in their briefs to us or in their oral arguments to us will cite to cases from other jurisdictions. Maybe South Carolina comes into play quite a bit, particularly in the area of domestic law. And we will consider that, but only after we've exhausted everything that our Supreme Court has directed us to look at by way of precedent and other cases that are argued from North Carolina's jurisdiction in the briefs of the council.
Thank you. Next question to Judges Calabria and Gray. And I guess Judge Gray goes first this time. Do you believe it is appropriate to use legislative history or the purpose of a statute in order to interpret the statute, as opposed to determining the meaning of a statute based on its words and phrases without regard to purpose? If you believe legislative purpose is a generally appropriate standard, does this give appellate judges room to lean on their policy preferences in interpreting the statute? Judge Gray.
Thank you. We have a difference here in North Carolina versus the United States Congress. The United States Congress keeps a voluminous congressional record, so you actually get to read about the debate and you get to read what you could interpret to be legislative intent. In the state of North Carolina, it's decidedly the opposite. There is no record. You might have a vote, but you have absolutely no history about what kind of debate took place and what could be interpreted as legislative intent. Perhaps that was intentional. I think it makes it very difficult then for a judge in North Carolina to, at the appellate level, to try to use that standard. Certainly if you have parties who have argued before you about paperwork that was presented to a committee, might be helpful as to why that particular law was passed if a interest group was behind it. But I think that if you have no legislative history to look at, then you are forced to look at the rules of statutory construction as contained in, I think it's still Chapter 12, I can be corrected on that, of the general statutes, and apply those rules as best you can to determine what the statute means. And if you stick to that, then I don't think you have to particularly delve into policy questions, and which gets to be treading dangerous ground.
Judge Calabria.
First, we have a statute. We'll look at the plain meaning of this, if there is the plain meaning of the statute. And if so, we don't have to look at the legislative intent. It's not necessary. If the statute is ambiguous, well, that's a different story. Then we would look at the legislative intent. Almost never do we get into, especially on our court, into any policy considerations. We are an error-correcting court, and all the policy decisions are made at the Supreme Court level.
The next question for Judge Gray and Mr. Perea. Prior to President Obama's nomination of Justice Sotomayor to the United States Supreme Court, he made the following statement about his selection. I will seek someone who understands that justice isn't about some abstract legal theory or footnote in a casebook. It is also about how our laws affect the daily realities of people's lives, whether they can make a living and care for their families, whether they feel safe in their homes and welcome in their own nation. I view that quality of empathy, of understanding, and identifying with people's hopes and struggles as an essential ingredient in arriving at just decisions and outcomes. Senator Sessions, in criticizing this criterion during the confirmation hearing, stated that there is a, quote, logical flaw in the empathy standard. Empathy for one party is always prejudice against another. What did the president and the senator mean? What, if any, is the proper role of empathy on an appellate court? Mr. Perea.
Okay. I think the place for empathy is at the trial court level. That's where judges have a broad amount of discretion. That's where they can apply mitigating circumstances. That's where they see the litigants face to face, and they can demonstrate empathy even just by paying attention as they're speaking. I don't think there's a lot of room for empathy at the appellate level. At the appellate level, we're primarily in error court, and we have to make sure that the law was applied as intended, so there's really not much of a place for empathy.
Judge Beer.
I'm not sure I would agree with the use of the word empathy, but I do agree with the fact that any good appellate judge has to keep in mind that the decision he or she is writing is going to affect the business. It's going to have an impact. It's going to affect individuals. It's going to affect their lives. You don't rule in that way, based on that. But what you do by remembering that these are real life cases, real life involving real people and real businesses, keeping that in mind is critical so that you, when you're writing your opinion, you are writing it in a way that everyone knows that they've been heard, that they know that you've been committed to researching this carefully, thoroughly, that you have heard the arguments, that you have treated those arguments with respect, that you have not brought any personal agenda or personal philosophy to play, that you are applying the law as it is to their case respectfully, even if they don't prevail. It's my goal when anyone, including the criminal defendant or the parties to a family law case or the multi-million dollar business dispute, when they get my opinion, I want them to read it, understand it, whether they're lawyers or not, and to feel that they got a fair shake, because this is their lives. And that's the role that I think being aware of that real parties are involved, I think that's the role for that. What we do has a huge impact. We cannot afford to make mistakes. We have got to get it right.
The next question will go to Judges Jackson and Steelman, with Judge Jackson responding first. How does your past life experience shape your approach to the law And how would you approach the work, or how do you, perhaps, is the better way to word it, the work of an appellate court judge?
Well, as you know, Justice Wichard, I began my career at the Supreme Court 20 years ago as a law clerk. So I am very honored to have the opportunity to run for a seat on the Supreme Court this year. After my clerkship, I was an associate general counsel in Governor Martin's office. I worked for an advocacy agency for persons with disabilities. I was in private practice doing land use and municipal law. And then I was general counsel to the Labor Department for 4 years before running for the Court of Appeals and being elected in 2004. Since being on the Court of Appeals, I have authored approximately 500 opinions and sat on an additional 1,000 cases. And I come from a background as an English and history major. I served on law review in law school for 2 years. And I bring to the job a passion for the law, a passion for legal research and writing, 20 years in the profession, and a real love for this profession, and particularly for the art of judging. And it excites me to think of being able to be a Supreme Court justice. It honors me and it humbles me. And that's what I bring to the table. And I am very hopeful that the folks that are considering me for this position will see that and understand that in me. Thank you.
Steele.
Yeah, I think Justice Scalia said that no judge comes to the court as a blank slate, and I don't think any of us do, and I certainly do not. I spent 18 years in the private practice of law in a small town, dealing with people, their individual problems, real estate, wills, estates, criminal, traffic matters, automobile litigation, just about any type case you could possibly imagine. And I can't think of any better training for the appellate court, the Court of Appeals, where we deal with every type of possible case than having done that. I spent 9 years on a town council, which is politics in its absolute rawest form. People wanting the town to intervene and make sure that the neighbor's dog stopped digging in their flower beds. So I understand what people are looking for in government, what they're looking for out of the legal system. I spent 3 years as county attorney in Union County, dealing with a lot of public works issues, building a jail, building a joint venture water plant in South Carolina, which has provided the county with the water necessary to for its growth. I've also spent 8 years on the trial bench where I've tried just about any type of case that you could imagine that would come up. And I think I'm getting ready to get the red card, so I'm going to stop.
Next question goes to Elmore and Walker, with Judge Elmore first. Appellate judges occasionally state that there is value to diversity on an appellate court. Diversity of background, gender diversity, cultural or religious diversity, viewpoint diversity, and diversity in different types of prior legal experience. Are there areas in which our appellate courts would benefit from more diversity, and if so, which type of diversity? Judge Elmore.
Well, that's a question best left to the people and the voters of North Carolina, because we elect our judges to the appellate courts, and they have the opportunity to review the backgrounds of the candidates in the voter's guide and newspaper editorials and elsewhere, and make an informed decision as to which of the candidates they would prefer to have on the appellate courts. And of course, that would take into consideration those candidates' qualifications, background, perhaps to some extent race, I doubt religion, maybe family background. But from my practical standpoint on the Court of Appeals, I think we have excellent diversity as is, so perhaps the voters have been wise over the last few years in the elections and maybe did consider some diversity in their selections. For myself, I had a background in criminal defense And my way of giving back was to represent indigent defendants at all levels in state and federal courts. I accepted those appointed cases when they were offered. I had fee-making opportunities in other cases, and I like to balance it out. So that's what I bring or have brought to the Court of Appeals. But we have other judges whose background is entirely different, who were district court judges or involved in corporate law in other areas.
Thank you. For Judges Calabria and Gray.
Can I answer that question?
Well, I'm sorry.
Because I was just going to say, I think we need some young people on the court. But I think it's important to have some diversity across, especially I liked what you said about, or what the question where they said, you know, about paralegal things, the things outside the legal realm. And I've been involved in farming, been involved in helping out with people during law school with different law firms, things like that. Worked other jobs through college. I've sold cutlery and vacuum cleaners and done all kinds of things like that. And then I've been blessed with the opportunity to be a pastor as well. And I think it's good. If you go back and look at a lot of our founders, a lot of the people that were influential during the founding of our country, you will see a lot of people with a heavy religious background. And I think it's a good thing for us to do that. And so I'm hoping to add a little diversity, especially in the age department.
Tell them the statistic you gave me earlier about how many judges have gone on the Court of Appeals while in their 30s.
We have had 12 judges of the Court of Appeals in their 30s. So it's not a travesty to make 13.
And if I had gotten there 3.5 months sooner, you'd have had one more. I was 40 when I went on it. All right, now, for Judges Calabria and Gray, and the question is, with Judge Calabria first, the mission of the North Carolina Judicial Department is, quote, to protect and preserve the rights and liberties of all the people as guaranteed by the constitutions and laws of the United States and North Carolina by providing a fair, independent, and accessible forum for the just, timely, and economical resolution of their legal affairs. If elected, how would you work to improve both the efficiency and accessibility of North Carolina's judicial system?
I would keep doing everything I've been doing for the last 8 years as an appellate judge, and prior to that, 6 years as a district court judge. When I first ran for district court, one of my roles was to tell everyone in Wake County that we needed custody mediation, because I moved up from Cumberland County, where we had mandatory custody mediation, but we didn't have it here. And everyone always said how great Raleigh was. And I thought, well, this isn't great if they don't have mandatory custody mediation. After I became a district court judge, and I was sitting in handling first appearances, and lots of people were in jail for the weekend, and I thought, well, they didn't need to be in jail for the weekend if they could speak English. And so then I arranged to have people sent for English classes, because they had no access to English classes, and the Literacy Council and I worked together, and we did that. On the Court of Appeals, very different job, very different for me coming from the district court, because, and that's what makes our court so diverse, because some of us are district court judges, and we have, instead of having all the discretion of being one judge, now I'm a third of the judge, as one of our judges would say, you're only a third of the judge. And you have hardly any discretion because we're an error-correcting court. But what I have, because I'm a juvenile court judge, the Literacy Council came back to me and asked me to help them. And we have now a juvenile literacy center at the Wake County Courthouse, where we handle the cases from the juvenile courts, and I provide it tutors for all these kids. We have about 45 kids in the program right now. We are the only county out of 100 counties in the state that are doing this, and our mentors and tutors are Campbell Law graduates. Sorry. Right. See, this is because I'm not looking at you.
Judge Gray.
Thank you. I haven't decided, should I be calling you Justice Witcher, Dean Witcher?
Your Most High Royal Excellency.
Your Most High. I thought I'd give you that chance. In which case, now I won't call you anything. But I admit to being a longtime policy wonk, for want of a better word, in the court system. I was proud to be an original member of the North Carolina Judicial Council, originally appointed by Chief Justice Frye, and I was retained by Chief Justice Lake and Chief Justice Parker, and it was a fabulous opportunity to review the court system as a whole. I then transitioned, because I was no longer eligible for the spot that I was in. I am now a member of the North Carolina Courts Commission, and something that I am doing there, also an appointee of the Chief Justice, and what I am desperately trying to do is to get that body fully appointed. It's a challenge when you have appointees by the governor, the president pro tem, the speaker, and the chief justice. And I think right now it's the chief justice who may be a couple of people behind on appointments. But we now actually have a chairman, and Senator Claude Felter. You can imagine that he's a little preoccupied with an election right now. But through the North Carolina Courts Commission, many, many issues have been addressed that have benefited the court system and will make it a better institution. That is my goal, is to continue to participate in that, listen to the participants, not only those of us who are a part of it, but also to the public, because there are public members to this commission. And it'll give us a great opportunity to try new ideas, problem-solving courts such as the family court system and things like the mental health courts. They're just untold things that we can do if we're given the opportunity.
Thank you. Next question for Judge Gere and Mr. Perea. Gere going first. The question is, there are several provisions of the North Carolina Constitution that are similar or identical to provisions in the U.S. Constitution. Some examples are the Equal Protection Clauses, the Law of the Land Due Process Clauses, the Right to Bear Arms Clauses, and the Freedom of Religion Clauses. How should our courts approach cases concerning whether the North Carolina Constitution is broader than the U.S. Constitution if no prior North Carolina case has addressed the issue?
Well, Justice Witcher, I have to say that the last time you were asking me questions, I was arguing in the Supreme Court, and they are just as thoughtful and just as challenging. But what I would say is we have Justice Witcher, we have Justice Newby there, and Justice Edmonds, and the Supreme Court has set out very clearly for the Court of Appeals, which is where I serve, how we should construe our state constitution. And even if you don't have a case directly on point, the court has indicated that the Due Process Clause, the Equal Protection Clause, the other clauses that are parallel to those in the federal constitution should be construed similarly. From time to time, our state Supreme Court has said that North Carolina, given its history, provides greater protection in its constitution in certain areas than the state than the federal constitution. That is, in my view, for the Supreme Court to say. And it is up to the Court of Appeals to apply that. And currently, I think the principles are laid out very clearly. There are a few provisions in the state constitution that have no parallel in the federal constitution, like the right to education. But most of these provisions have also been interpreted by our Supreme Court. And it is the role of the Court of Appeals to apply the law as established by the Supreme Court, and not for us to make our own way.
I agree with Judge Gere on virtually everything that she said. And I would emphasize in particular the point that there are some additional protections, some additional rights given in our Constitution that are not evident in the federal Constitution. In those areas, we need to extend those additional protections to our citizens. On things like the issue of education, that we have a right to education, we have to be careful to recognize that the right exists, but not to try and decide how that right should be applied. If you think of the Leandro decision and the controversies that developed through that, it's okay for an appellate judge to say, hey, there's a right to education here. It's not being observed. It needs to be fixed, but it's not the place of a judge to fix it. It's the place of the legislature or the executive branch to fix it.
All right, let me make a statement here. We are heading into the last two questions given me by the society. In order to make this come out so each group of judges has been given the same number of questions, I have devised two more, and I think we will be within our time limit. It's my understanding the judges have seen the questions that...
No.
You hadn't seen these questions?
No.
Okay, well, then I will just hold mine, too. Let you respond blindly to those as well. Okay. I'm sure they've thought about all these things. I will announce what my last one is going to be. The last one, which will be for Judge Gere and Mr. Perea, is to respond to any one of the questions asked that you were not asked. Pick one of the questions that was asked and respond to it. All right. Judges Jackson and Steelman, with Judge Steelman first. Currently, the Court of Appeals considers cases using three judge panels with no option for hearing a case en banc, that is, a rehearing by the entire Court of Appeals. In the past, this has on occasion led to situations where two panels have issued inconsistent opinions, with the litigants having no avenue to ask for clarification from the whole Court of Appeals. Would an en banc hearing process be worth the extra time and expense for the Court of Appeals?
And with all due respect to Professor Orth, who has written extensively on this, I think we have en banc review. It's called the North Carolina Supreme Court. Given the volume of cases that we deal with, which is 15 to 1,800 cases per year, I just don't think that having en banc review is practicable. I just don't think so. I understand for the lawyers it can be frustrating on occasion. I remember there was one opinion day where there were two opinions from our court handed down on the same day on the identical issues that went in 180-degree differences, and there was one judge who sat on both cases. Now, I cannot give you a good explanation for that. That should not happen. But we do have other mechanisms. You can petition for rehearing. There are other mechanisms that will deal with those types of situations. And I just don't feel like en banc review is a good mechanism.
Judge Jackson.
And I agree with Judge Steelman. I think as a simple logistical, practical matter, when you come to our court for a swearing in, there are 15 of us. It is a nightmare trying to fit all of us on the bench. So if it were an oral argument for en banc hearing, it would be quite challenging just from a physical standpoint. From a practical standpoint, or from a more theoretical intellectual standpoint, I do think it is the role of the Supreme Court to resolve these disputes between our panels. And, you know, I would certainly, with my recency on this court, the Court of Appeals, if I'm fortunate enough to join the Supreme Court, I would certainly hope to encourage that. I recognize that joining that court as a junior justice, the seventh of seven, I understand very well that that role is the junior justice, but that would certainly be something that I would hope to contribute to the court, is an understanding of the frustration that our court has split panels occasionally. We see it. We understand the frustration that leads to internally within the court, and we hear from attorneys that it leads to frustration for them.
Having just been on the losing end of a 7-4 vote to deny a petition for an en banc hearing in the Fourth Circuit, I can tell you the lawyers can still be frustrated even when the mechanism exists. All right, for Elmore and Walker, Section 35 of the Declaration of Rights in the North Carolina Constitution reads as follows: a frequent recurrence to fundamental principles is absolutely necessary to preserve the blessings of liberty. State what this statement means to you. And Mr. Walker, you are first this time.
I think it means you don't forget where you came from as a state. You don't forget what it was like before we set out that there were these inalienable rights that were given, that we were given by our Creator to go and to have these rights. I think part of the problem we maybe get into sometimes is we think of the Constitution as giving us our rights, but the Constitution just sets them down and says, no, you can't infringe on these rights. These were rights that existed on the basis of us being human beings. And I think we need to remember that, that we have those rights because we are human, not because the government has given us these rights. What we're doing is we're standing in front of the government, we're saying, no, you will not take this right that God has given us away from us. And I think that we need to do that often, to go back and look at those founding principles and remember what they are and make a frequent recurrence to them.
And I would tend to agree with the substance of Mr. Walker's response. I think we should always look first to our God-given rights, and that we do have founders of the Constitution that did an excellent job in giving us guidance, such as Section 35. But we have to remember the book of Genesis and where we came from, and interpret the all the provisions of the Constitution in light of the entire picture. And I that's my interpretation of what the Section 35 means to me.
All right. For Judges Calabria and Gray, with Judge Gray going first, is there or is there not a subjective element in judging? After a yes or no answer, offer any comments on the subject that you wish to.
I would probably have to answer the qualified yes. And I think it gets back to the question about the experience that we bring. We are human beings. We are not automatons. And so you cannot sit there and hear a case and ignore what happens in front of you. You're there to judge the credibility of a witness. I mean, that requires you to apply subjective standards. And you can't sit there and say, he twitched when he answered. That means he's a liar. I mean, there's not a system for doing that. You have to exercise your ability of how you judge the credibility of people by your own experience. So I think that's fundamental at the trial level. And you certainly don't use that standard, of course, when you're then applying the law. That's not the standard. I'll leave it at that.
I want to use this chance to talk about a case. It was a domestic violence case. In that case, we had an appellant's brief, no appellee's brief. And this happens a lot, and it's troublesome. We also had no transcript. So that was just lovely. But we did have what's called a recitation, and I had to check the rules on that, and that's fine, except in a recitation, you have to put question and answer, so you have to write down what everybody said. Well, we never could find out what the appellee said. So it would have been fine if we would have known what she said. We needed the subjective part of that so that we could make a decision in the case. So we affirmed the trial court on that. We had a majority decision after meeting a lot. But that is one of the biggest examples, or the best example I can use for a subjective element, because without knowing what our appellee said, and we just had no other choice but to rule in, because the trial judge was there. We're an error-correcting court, and that's what we do on the Court of Appeals.
Thanks. And you folks have heard the last question with Mr. Pariah first. Pick any one of the questions asked of other candidates, not to you and your opponent, and give your answer.
Okay. I like that question on looking to the law of other jurisdictions and foreign law. I think it's entirely appropriate to look at the law of other U.S. jurisdictions in cases of first impression. In matters, for example, of corporate law, it would be entirely appropriate to look at the law of Delaware, where they've dealt extensively with corporate law, or New York. As to questions or looking to foreign law, absolutely not. We have a unique American legal tradition of which we should be proud. And if you think about it, the only ones who look to foreign law are those who are not satisfied with what they find in our American legal tradition. I had someone ask me the other day about a case in New Jersey where a judge decided to apply Sharia law in a domestic matter, permitting a man to beat his wife and basically get away with it. There is zero place for Sharia law in American law. And when we start playing these games of saying, well, take this from them and this from them, we lose our unique American legal tradition, and that is the worst form of judicial activism.
Judge Gere.
I'm going to respond to the question I think Judge Jackson and Judge Steelman had, which is, what do you bring to the table? And I bring 7 years, actually now more, almost, we're heading on to 8 years on the Court of Appeals. And during that time, I'm fortunate that the Supreme Court has been kind enough to reverse me rarely. More than 98% of the time, my opinion has stood as the law in that case. I have been honored and humbled that to have judges and lawyers from across the state tell me that they especially like my opinions because they clearly and precisely set out the law in a very matter-of-fact way that can be readily applied in other cases. They don't have to wonder, as one Superior Court judge said to me about another opinion, they don't have to wonder what they actually did wrong and what do they need to do to fix it. That has meant a great deal to me. We take each appeal very seriously. The folks in my chambers are working on it. We research them carefully and try to write the opinion precisely. I bring almost 20 years of private practice representing individuals and corporations in the state and the federal courts at the trial level and at the appellate level. I've been in the Fourth Circuit. I've been in the U.S. Supreme Court. I've been in my Court of Appeals and this is, numerous times. I understand the role of the Court of Appeals judge. I know that we apply the law set out by the General Assembly. We apply the law set out by the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, the North Carolina Supreme Court, and we do so in a way that is fair and even-handed.
Let me again thank the Federalist Society for sponsoring this exercise in democracy, the candidates for submitting themselves to this process, and all of you for caring enough to come. Robert, are there any announcements from the Society? We kept this within the hour, I want to say, which was our goal, and yet everybody had a chance to respond to an equal number of questions. Anything from the Society? If not, I again thank you for coming and declare this meeting adjourned.
Thank you.